Good evening. I'm Pastor Stephanie Page. I'm Stephanie Page.
And I'm Jonathan Lee Page.
And tonight we have a very serious, very necessary segment on the Page Speak. Well, we're going to be speaking about racism and if it has caused PTSD or post-traumatic stress syndrome within our community. Many times when we think about PTSD, we only think of it in regards to people who have been in active military battle. But in actuality, within our community, we've actually been in a battle for hundreds of years.
Yes.
To be able to be recognized, to have a voice, and to not feel as though we are insufficient to have the same rights and the same privileges as everyone else. So we're going to talk about the effects of many things that have been happening and have happened through history, even the things that have been happening in the past couple of years, the things we've seen, the things we have felt, even within our spirits as things have occurred. So tonight, we're going to be listening to different aspects. We're going to be hearing from different generations. First, I'd like to bring up Ms. Jessica Robbins. And Jessica Robbins is a young woman who's really on the front lines, being in the school system and the public school system as a teacher. She's also been on the front lines in regards to marching and having a voice in regards to things that happen that are indicative of the unfairness and the injustice that we experience. Yeah. And Jessica is definitely a millennial voice. So welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
And we also
awesome.
Hallelujah. In a minute, we're gonna have you say a little bit about yourself. Actually, go ahead. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jessica.
Okay. Well, as you said, I'm a millennial. I'm definitely Black. I'm from Detroit. I'm in the suburbs right now. I teach in a Black school. I went to college at white schools for both of my degrees. And so I've kind of seen how both worlds operate. And I see what it's like being a young African-American professional in both of those avenues.
Come on, man.
Well, so you have a voice and you want to hear what you have to say. Amen. Also, we have David Brown. And David Brown is a seasoned man of God who's experienced lots of things across the country, lots of people. He has years of experience in regards to maneuvering through racist environments. And David is definitely a voice that needs to be heard. I mean, just personally, he's someone that means a lot to Pastor Joe and myself.
Yeah.
And he is coming on as a voice for the baby boomers in regards to the effects that racism has had on us as a community, as us as individual people, and even the stress of living in a society that doesn't necessarily regard you in the way that you ought to be regarded. So introducing David Brown, you have anything? Just introduce yourself, sir.
Well, God bless you all. It's just a pleasure to be here with you, Pages, and to be a part of this discussion. I don't claim to be an expert on issues, but you know, sometimes you can just sit back and you can watch. And in my case, coming from a position of the church and also coming from the position of the corporate world, I've always had 2 feet in each world, in the corporate world and in the church. And I do not find it surprising that when you start pulling back the covers and you start pulling back the layers, that it's the same racism that is in the corporate world, it's in America, that is in the church. The only reason we have not actually dealt with it because over the past 20 years, we have been a separate being. Martin Luther King said that the most segregated time in America is at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. So as we started coming together and started crossing our racial boundaries and cultural boundaries, we begin to find out that some of those same racist attitudes, and we see it play out today in the insurrection. And these people are the same folk that, 6 months ago, we were holding hands singing Kumbaya with, and now these same people are arming themselves with AK-47s and speaking in tongues at the same time. So, you know, we really need to have a real conversation. And if the church sits back and not take an active role and call a spade and speak truth to power, we are in trouble. So I just came to live my little opinion. I don't mean to minimize my opinion, but I'm a voice in the wilderness, and I will cry aloud and spare not when the Lord touches me to do so. So thank you for this opportunity and for inviting me.
Awesome. Right. Awesome. So everyone that's watching, we want to really encourage you to share. Yes. This is a discussion that needs to be heard. It's a discussion that needs to happen. And like I said, we have friends of every race, every creed. Share it. Go hit your share button and send it personally to people's inboxes. People need to hear this discussion. So when we first started to breach this subject in regards to racism in the community, my thought was that, you know, as a community, the Black community, I believe we have PTSD. And why I say that is because we have been feeling the effects of the lie of superiority of one race over another for hundreds of years. From the time where they thought we were savages and able to enslave us, abuse us, rape us, kill us, to the time that even we came out of slavery and they fought very hard for us not to be considered as full human beings, to the times when we finally got those, similar to those rights, but they thought that we weren't good enough to drink out of the same water fountains or to go to the same schools. You look on television and the portrayals of Black people, they're either stupid or they're thugs or they're a maid, and there's no, the portrayal, you know. I was talking to a friend of mine, the shows that we had that, you know, it was almost like a programming that Good Times was living in a ghetto in the projects and hanging in a child line, Good Times. So this is what is, oh, this is Good Times for Black people. The redlining, where we couldn't live in particular areas because, oh, we weren't of the same caliber. We have our grandfathers that fought in wars, but then were not allowed the same access to houses and the GI bills that the ones that they fought next to received. We know about the police state, and that's, you know, something else that has recently come to the forefront with the Breonna and Floyd and Steele, and just, it's just so much. It's so many of them, and it's so often, and it's almost like a regular occurrence, and to the point where when videos come up, I can't even watch them because I have an internal reaction to the point where it's just like I tighten up. And this is something that is being, like I said, is really before our eyes. And then we wonder why things are still being perpetrated. And then we have the other side to it where other races think that we're just uptight. And then we always have an attitude. And why do they always want to pull the race card and just get over it? You're just being victims. You're just playing the victim all the time. And they're not understanding. Listen. This has been going on since way before I can remember. It's never stopped. That's the whole point. It has never stopped. And, you know, why would we not be touchy? You know, why would we not be sensitive to overt as well as covert racism? So, you know, when we talk about this, even as a community, and I'm going to turn this over to you guys, as a community, we wonder why, you know, why do our young people sometimes have such brash attitudes where they're just like, I'm not even trying to deal with you. We wonder why we have this absolute, you know, cancel, you know, say one thing racist, you're done. I'm not dealing with you no more. You're just canceled, period. And we're wondering why there's even more of a division that's being perpetrated now. But is it because, again, we've dealt with this. It's never, ever fully gone away. And now it's a part of us, and we're sensitive to it, and we just cannot ignore the implications. But I want to hear your take on it, Jessica, David, whichever one you want to jump in.
I'll go ahead and jump in. One of the last things that you said about this divide, and it seems like it's getting bigger, and I talk about this a lot with people in my circle. I don't think the divide is getting bigger. We're just looking and saying, hey, maybe there is actually a problem. We've never been close in this nation. If you look at even the way we've been brought over here, even the way the Native Americans were here, if we want to go into just all the race relations, we've never been a nation that was united. Our states have always been very divided. And the whites in power have a good way of gaslighting things and to making us think that things are okay, making us think that, yes, we have overcome power to the people. Y'all got this. Look, all the businesses are saying Black Lives Matter, but nothing has changed. And one thing that I really appreciate from Donald Trump is that he helped to show the world, look, this is what's going on in America. We're trying to make America great, and we're trying to take it back to a time when America was great. And of course, a lot of Black people are looking at that saying, well, when was that? And the white people was like, oh, you know when that is, but don't nobody want to come right out and actually say America was great when things, well, people are saying it. You're right. Mm-hmm. But just in mainstream, people are just trying to gloss over things like ain't nothing happening. And I'm appreciative of the spotlight that's being put on the divide. Yes. It's a little tense, and it's kind of like I don't know which way things are going to go with this, especially with the folks rising up with their AK-47s and stuff. People been talking about they trying to do a civil war and all that good stuff. I mean, I'm not for war. We got to find a way to fix this, but we are not together. Never have been.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. One of the things that I am noticing, and I don't mind aging myself. I turned 60 in October, I am a baby boomer, and one of the things I started noticing, in my early 40s, as I got older, that the younger generation was always saying to us, you guys, you're so angry, you're not open, and things are changed now, and I was saying, no, they're not. I'm dealing with these folk every day. They're just subtle about it. They soon call you the N-word, and look at you, and you can see it, you can feel it. And I said, no, it's still there. It just has not risen up. Well, what you mean? We can go anywhere we want to go. We can do anything we want to do. I said, no, you can't. It's just some things that you have not been exposed to, and you're not reading the numbers. You're not looking at the disparities. You're not looking at the economic situation. Well, we're in a capitalistic system, and we're not in a capitalistic system. We're in an oligarchical system. In other words, the top 10% of the people hold the wealth, and then you got the middle class that's being eroded every day. All of the housing crisis affected, and it took away over 66% of Black wealth, and it was by design. The problem is, at this point in time, they see a disparity, and that's why they don't want the Voting Rights Act to be equal. Well, it's our whole democracy is based upon voting. And we know that if we would have abolished the electoral vote system, that it would have been a Democratic or a independent president without the Republican Party or without the Democratic Party. Those systems are designed to eradicate the middle class because of the rise in the number of the people of color in the United States. So by year 2036 or 2034, I believe it is, whites in America will no longer be the majority. It will be people of color. And they're afraid. They're afraid of losing their supremacist power. They're afraid of equality because, you know what? I'm like James Brown. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Just open up the door and I'll get it myself. I just want the same opportunity as that person that is next to me that don't have the same skin color. And when we've been, and history proves, when we've been given equal footing, race doesn't matter, because guess what? Because of our determination and because of our character, we're going to win every time. All we need is a fair opportunity to participate in the financial system, in the educational system, in all the systems, and we will produce, because guess what? We are all basically of the same race. We're of the human race. We just got a little bit more melanin in our skin. So we gotta come up a little bit higher. So
okay. I had conversations with people inside the church. We got a bit of it. I don't know where that is. But we've had conversations with people even inside the church. And the attitude has been, especially as of late, as voices have been speaking, that listen, we're not going to just settle for this anymore. So we've had voices that have come up and said, you know, listen, what's the problem? You can do the same things we can do. You know, I've had to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I don't know why you people, and again, you people are so angry. Why are you always feeling as though you're victimized? When you have a victimized mentality, that's why you all remain victims. And this is the mindset of people inside the church. And my viewpoint of it is that, you know, things are gonna affect you. Things affect you. If you've been told your entire life that you're inferior, if everything around you, other than your own community, has been that you're inferior, when you see, even within schools, I don't, you know, Jessica to speak about that later, that the atmosphere is just different. The opportunities sometimes are different depending on if you're in a predominantly Black area or predominantly white area. You see where certain things, like I'm gonna give this example. My daughter today, as we were talking, my daughter today was driving through Ohio. And she called me and she says, you know, right now I need you on the phone because I'm entering into an area and I don't see any Black people. And I'm a little nervous. I'm a little nervous. So I just want to have you on the phone. I'm letting you know where I am and where I'm going. And it was a genuine nervousness. Coming up, I knew that there are certain parts of Michigan you don't go in.
Certain cities, absolutely.
Certain cities, you just don't go in. Why? For your own life, for your own personal safety. You go there, you may not come out. Right? When we think about, again, the trauma, my grandfather was actually murdered in Alabama. He was driving a car, and a truck from a Caucasian trucking company ran him off the road and ran over him. It was an accident. You know, there was no repercussions. Everything got swept under the rug. No, the police reports all disappeared. You know, this was in the 60s. And this is something that's in my family history, something that I know happens. To the point where when I'm driving down south, there are some cities, it's like, you don't wanna make sure you're full of gas before you hit this city, before you hit this area. That puts inside of you a certain type of uneasiness and fear that you have to live with. You live with it. And so have you all ever been in situations where you really felt unsafe? Because there was nobody that looked like you.
Yeah, a lot.
yeah.
A few years ago, so my mom has some friends in Tennessee. And if you know anything about Tennessee, that's one of them places that you just don't go unless you got reason to be there. And so she wanted to go and see these people. And so I'm like, all right, we'll do a road trip. You know, I got a week off, let's go. And I remember the night before, I was in the bathroom looking in the mirror, and I was practicing talking to police officers. I was in the mirror. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. No, say it a little less intimidating. Okay. Yes, sir. No, sir. I'm sorry. Okay. Hands on the steering wheel. Like I practiced going through all these different motions in case something happened. And I made sure, you know, all my papers were in order. If I had to go to something, it was out where they could see it. me and my mom are both CPL holders, and so they can pull it from my license plate that they know that we might be armed in there. So that's a whole nother situation. Got to keep everything where you can see it. Don't want to put anybody in danger. And so thankfully, you know, we went there and back safely. We didn't have no issues. But when we went to our people's house, they was like, now, look, you're going to have to leave before it gets dark. Because, I mean, I can keep you safe right here, but y'all still got to drive back to the hotel. So we don't want no issues happening while you're here. So we definitely had to be on our P's and Q's there. And that was just a long-term road trip. But I mean, even here, like I went to MSU driving through Howe. Don't go 1 mile over the speed limit. Don't look at no crazy officers. At one time I was driving a really older car and I think I had just got insurance on it. I was so glad because they would always try and find me on 96 and they would pull me over. What you pulled me over for? Oh, well, you driving in the wrong lane. Okay. What you pulled me over for this time? Oh, well, I had something hanging from the rearview mirror. Oh, you know, that's illegal to have that there. Oh, okay, officer. I'm sorry. I'll take it down. And so it's always something, even in Lansing, just driving around at night on campus. That's a whole nother story because campus police is one thing, but just in the general city, always stopping you. Why? Why are you stopping me?
Wow. Pastor David?
Well, I don't think that there is an African-American man in America that has not at one time or another been profiled and pulled over by the police and asked to get out of their car and, you know, searched, you know, kneeled down. It wasn't that bad with me, but I know on a couple occasions I was profiled in Denver, Colorado one time going through a particular neighborhood on my way home. And when I pulled over, the next thing I know, there was like 8 cars surrounded me and all white cops. All of them had their hands on their weapons. And I just knew the rules that my mom and dad taught me. Look, put your hands on the steering wheel. Don't make no sudden moves. Keep calm. You know, all of us look alike. So there you have it. But the one time I really had a fear for my life is when I was in college. And the choir had taken a engagement to Indianapolis, Indiana. And we were on our way back to the campus of Central State University. And we had a great big bus with all the choir members on it. And we had 2 vans with other choir members on it. And the bus drivers decided to stop at this place that we saw because it was that night. And we knew we wanted to get something to eat before we got back to campus. And he pulled over. And so we got out the bus and several of us went into the bathroom. Others of us went to where they were serving. It was a cafeteria. And literally, this was like out of a scene of a movie. The whole restaurant came to a stop. Literally, you know how the music on the jukebox is playing? The music stopped. It was like 10 or 15 of us in there in the line looking at the menu. And we all looked around, and if all the people, there had to be like maybe 45 people in there, it was a complete hush. Nobody said anything. It's like the whole restaurant came to a stop. And then our chaperone ran in there, and she looked at us. She was waving everybody, come on out. And she said, I don't know why we stopped here. She was asleep when the bus driver stopped. She said, this is the campdown for the Ku Klux Klan. And just pray that they don't follow us in their trucks when we got out of there, because it's a bus full of college kids. We didn't know, and we just kept looking out the window. Fortunately, nobody followed us, and we got out of there. But that was one time, because I've never had that to happen to me in my life. So those incidents happen, and, you know, that was early in my life. But now they don't care. You know, you meet them in a grocery store, you know. Yeah, I'm a Klansman, you know. What about it? So really emboldened. So those are my experiences. Yeah.
What about you? Well, I've experienced it when playing basketball. I went to a junior college in Iowa. And I had came from California. I was at one school and came to this school where a couple of my friends were playing in Iowa. And when I came there, we both went there and tried out, and we were exceptionally good at that particular point. But they had boosters. And this was like it's an all-white town. So they only wanted to really pump the white players, so to speak. So when we got down there, no matter how hard we played, no matter how good we was, we were basically labeled or pushed aside to push other people that didn't have as much talent. And we find that in society that we can be working triple time, you know what I'm saying, working as hard to be able to do more to try to be accepted in a society of people that basically don't care how good you are. They don't care nothing about your character. They don't even care about who you are as a person. They only care about pushing themselves or pushing their agenda past you. And it's like, it's more than competition. This is like, it's like almost domination to a degree, that they want to dominate. They don't care how they win. They just want to win.
And so with these situations, we look at the effect, again, even as a child having to have the talk, you know, when you get pulled over by a police officer, put your hands in the steering wheel, don't move. You can't, again, you could own a gun, but, you know, when you own a gun, you still carry the chance that somebody may be threatened by you and they'll kill you, even though you have a legal right to carry a gun just like others. I look in society, you have people open carrying all kinds of even assault weapons just walking around. And I was like, if I even had a legal right to do that and did that, it would not turn out the same way. So when you're in a society and you know, because it's really sort of obvious through the actions and the behaviors in regards to that you're not valued as much as others, that you are thought of many times as less than. So then when people say, well, I don't see color. I don't see color. And I'm like, well, that's impossible. you know, looking at me, you do see that I have more melanin than you. It's impossible to not see color. But what that does is it actually removes the necessity for you to put yourself in someone else's shoes to see what they're dealing with. So within, you know, you have a lot of people that may have maybe some compassion for what you're dealing with. Aw, you know, but not necessarily the empathy. Empathy is the act of putting yourself in someone else's shoes and having to experience what they experience. So while you're telling us to get over it, and while you're saying, oh, you're playing the race card, while you're saying, oh, you know, things are different now, you have yet to put yourself in our shoes where you don't have to give your kids that talk. You can go anywhere for the most part and know that you're not going to be treated differently because of the color of your skin. You can go into a store. You're not going to have to worry about if you go into a store that you can afford to shop in, if you're going to be automatically followed by security. You don't necessarily have to deal with the stereotypes that have been perpetrated for hundreds of years and overcoming them. I was looking at a special about the Black church, and it was very interesting. It was something that happened when they came out of slavery, and they, after the war, after the Civil War, and they came out of slavery and they started establishing their churches. One thing that they believed is that the most important thing was education. So you had men who knew God, who operated in the gifts of the Spirit of God, could cast out demons and do all kinds of wondrous works, but they were not regarded because the African-American community said that we have to show that we're just as smart and just as good as they are. So get your education. You have to have these degrees to operate. You have to operate in a certain methodology, and you really have to conform so that they will believe that you're just as good as they are. And I thought about that, and I said, they're still controlling us. It was still a control move, because what you were doing was not so that you can advance spiritually. but so that others who didn't think that you were good enough may possibly think that now you were their equal because you had education. And so the motive behind doing some things was in order to be viewed as good enough. How often are we still doing things in order to be viewed as good enough? How often are we talking a particular way or hide? I mean, we all know how to shift our voices in order to speak in a way in corporate America that will be accepted. We all know that, you know, when you go into some environments, I mean, I'll go into a place with my hair like this and people just look at me. And as soon if I wear a straight hairstyle, oh, I love your hair like that. You know, and it's, you know, just automatically like who we are and how we present ourselves is not good enough. So do you still see people moving to try to prove themselves as good enough to white society, I would say?
Are you giving this to me? Okay. I absolutely think so. I studied education at MSU, Michigan State University, and I was in the urban educators cohort. And so they grabbed a bunch of us from Detroit, put us together to make sure, you know, we could get a good quality education and then come back to the inner city and teach. And in that cohort, I had a Black professor whom I still love to this day. And she really broke down a lot of these things that were going on with African Americans in the education system. And our cohort was about, let's say, half Black, half white. And one thing that she really talked about was code switching. Now, at the time, I had never heard that terminology, but we all know we got our white people voice and we got our Black people voice. You got the voice you use on the phone and you got the voice you use at home. And so she really just broke that down. And I remember the white people being in class like, huh? Y'all do that? What are you talking about? No, that doesn't happen. And we all just sitting there like, yeah. I remember, so I teach at a Black school, but I'm still supposed to be the professional. And then it kind of brings the question of what does professionalism look like? Is professionalism whiteness or is professionalism, can I bring my culture into it? And so oftentimes a lot of the students think that I'm from I live in the suburbs now, but they really think I'm from the suburbs. They think that I hang around a bunch of white people just because of the way I speak at times. One day after class, it was lunchtime, I picked up the phone to order food from Coney Island. And I guess I just started talking normal at that time. And the kids was like, Miss Robbins, that's how you talk. And I was like, what you talking about? And I was like, and it was like, man, you just sound like you was one of us. I was like, I'm from right around the corner. Why would you think that I'm any different or that I would sound any different? And it was like, well, why do you talk white? Why are you teaching us? I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, you know, you speak with these, they're not even big words, but just the way you say them. Why you talk like that? And I was like, well, I was taught that when you're in a professional setting and you're doing these things, you have to do things perfect and correct. And unfortunately, the white way of speaking is standard English here. And so if I want to have a job, if I want to keep paying rent, this is the way I have to speak. And it was just an eye-opening situation for all of us right there.
Wow. Well, my contribution to that is too in some personal experience. Number one, the first thing is, you know, talking about the Black church, us African American Negro colored folk. So I think everybody. We went through a period, and some of us are still going through. I call it the double A. And it's called either the accommodationist or the assimilist. So either you accommodate or you assimilate. Now, all of us to a particular degree, because of what we do, we learn to speak the King's English. Some of us have learned to speak in such a way that, you know, you still know that we're a brother, but we use proper sentence structure until we get each other. Then we go back to Ebonics because that's who we are, that's home, that's mama, that's daddy, all this. So because of our positions in our jobs, we know how to change that language. And if you want to survive, if you want to get in the door for that interview, there's some things you have to do. Now, I'm going to say a good one, and the pages can identify with this, because when they first met me, I had locks.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yeah.
So I had locks from 2003, just like you, my sister. My locks are all the way down my back. Believe it or not, the most resistance I got with the locks was from my own black brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And even more so, my black brothers and sisters that was a part of the apostolic and the prophetic. Mm-hmm. I literally went to an apostolic conference and people rolled their eyes at me because they had been taught that anybody who wear locks, either they're gay or it's demonic.
Wow.
One of the top names talking about she cut her son's locks off because they were demons. Come on. Come on. How ignorant can you get?
Come on, man.
So my thing was, okay, so if the demons are in the locks, how come you just didn't cast them out?
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Y'all get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we buy into what we think the dominant culture wants from us, and so they will set values for us that they don't even consider valuable themselves, and we're trying to buy into it. See, that was the whole problem with the movement, and what's going on now is because we're so busy trying to make our theology or our experience with God fit into theirs, and it don't fit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and you all asked me when I came on, you know, if you go on my page, and my prophet David Brown, and my apostle David Brown, well, you know what, I learned people will call me as they see me, and I'm okay, but guess what, you can call me Dave, because no matter what the title is, I'm going to do what God calls me to do, and in this season, this time, I think what we ought to do is do away with titles altogether, because the proof is going to be in the pudding. And what we've got to do is we got to start having these conversations, because guess what? We know they're crazy. You know, I don't care what they're crazy, y'all. So what you going to do? You going to go and get your cookie cutter and be crazy with them? You going to do the same things that they're doing? No. It's time for us to come back and redo our theology, redo who we know God to be. We cannot adopt that. See, that's what happened in the beginning of the Word movement. You know, remember everybody, we used to have Baptist churches and Methodist churches and all that. Then all of a sudden, everybody started being Christian sinners. Wait a minute, what happened to Baptists and Methodists and the rich tradition? No, and then we put away our wood pulpits, and we got our little glass pulpits. We sat down the deacons and put away the choir, and we got praise teams. Well, they got praise teams because they can't sing. And we're going to try to adopt what they do. So we try to build our churches based upon their culture and their values. So what are we going to do now? Now we know that stuff don't work. We know it don't work. So we got to go back to God and say, God, how do we restructure this? How do we restructure a theology that is an inclusive theology? How do we restructure our understanding of you? Because God's not changing. It's our understanding of God that changes. And while I'm at it, I'm going to say this, and y'all going to get mad at me. Let me tell you something. Sexism, racism, and homophobia, they're best of buddies. And when you find one, you'll find the other one.
Wow.
We got to redo our theology on homosexuality. We got to redo our theology on racism. We got to redo our theology on sexism. God's been waiting on us. Yeah. God's been waiting on us to do it. He's there already. And I can prove he's there already. We just won't change. Everybody wants everybody else to change, but we don't want to change ourselves. We got to do the homework. We got to ask the hard questions, and we got to do the homework. Okay, I'm done.
Nobody's going to get mad at you. You're on the page to speak.
Okay.
What I wanted to say really quickly, because I want to go back to the, again, changing the hair to conform. Changing clothing to conform. And again, God made our hair the way that they made it. Who are you to say something's wrong with it? God made our skin the way he made it. Who are you to say something's wrong with it? But the issue is, I believe that even generations past, because again, I'm talking about PTSD, believed the lie that something was wrong. Hence, let me straighten your hair so that you'll be able to conform. Let me dress you in a way that you're not intimidating so you can be able to conform. Because their way of doing it, I think they believe that there was a superiority. So looking at that, my ancestors, and I'm going to tell you, I'm just going to talk about the PTSD that I had to deal with within myself. I told you how my grandfather was killed. My grandmother, my mother, they, before I left out the house, everything had to be perfect because they didn't want anyone saying that I did, that something was not right. And so my hair had to be right. It had to be straight. I had to be dressed a certain way. It had to be right. And everything had to conform and fit in with what was proper according to the societal norms. And the societal norms were not set by our community, okay? So in knowing that when my hair got wet and frizzed up, oh no, I got bad hair, you know? Because you had either good hair, which was straight, or bad hair that was not. In our community, you have the light skin and dark skin. Okay. And so if you're light skinned, you're pretty. Why? Because you're closer to being the color of Caucasians. If you're dark skinned, you're not as pretty. Or I've heard the term, oh, you're really cute for a dark skinned girl. So these things brought about a sense of insecurity in me that as I was not good enough. So then I got on this treadmill of trying to be perfect, trying to be right, trying to prove myself to others, trying to do things to be accepted instead of living out who I am, valuing who God made me to be, walking in the gifts that God has given me, understanding that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, and I don't have to change for anyone. But the PTSD or the trauma that had been instituted in our parents, again, make sure that you look right so they don't hurt you. Make sure you dress right so they don't kill you. Make sure that you're walking right, you're talking right so that they don't do anything to you. Will cause you to doubt yourself and to draw in just so that you can fit and not be hurt. Many in the society are still walking that walk. That's trauma. Yeah. And many in this society, not only are they walking that walk, but they're perpetrating it further in the children. That's trauma. And then you have the other side that's walking in rebellion saying, I refuse to do anything that they want us to do. Right. And so now it's sort of like off the hook. You know, it's like the whole other direction. You know, I'm not going to make you go to school. I'm not going to discipline you. What you do is what you do, Ray Ray. You know, it's like whatever it is. And so these to me are signs of the PTSD that we are still living with as a society. And I believe that one of the roles of the church is to teach people, God loves you right where you are, just as you are. He did not leave, you are fearfully and wonderfully made. He will never leave you nor forsake you. He knows you from the inside out, not from the inside in, that's not his issue. And that we as a church have to walk the same way. We as a community. So the PTSD has infiltrated our community, be it the Christian community or the Black, African-American, colored, however you want to identify, community. All right. And we really have to grab a hold of that monster and really start teaching and talking to one another with value, honoring one another. Like Apostle David was talking about, it doesn't matter about your title. I'm going to honor you because you're a child of God. You're a human being. I'm going to honor you and love you because God loves you. How about that? All right. I'm going to treat you with value because God treats you with value. God so loved you that he sent his son for you. That's how much value you have. So while we have a lot of tearing down because of external things and a lot of beating up because of opinions, we as a community got to get beyond all that and start seeing each other as sons and daughters of God that have value, that have worth, and we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And that's what I wanted to really get to on today. We're going a little bit over our time, but we really have to deal with the PTSD that's in this community, and we really got to build each other up. We got exactly 2 minutes. Jessica and David, I'm going to throw it to you for another minute and a half.
Okay, well, I agree 100% with what you just said, and I'll just add with that, that in the African-American community, there's been a stigma about counseling and going to therapy. And anybody who's going through any type of trauma, you need help. You need to go through therapy. So it's like a double-edged sword at us. Like we're in this issue with these with this trauma that we have, but don't nobody want to go get help. Don't nobody want to admit that we have it. And it's okay to say, hey, I have a problem. Hey, I need a professional to help me through this. And so I think that that's one thing that we need as a community to help us move on.
Amen. David?
Well, I do agree. There are so many issues that, with the PTSD that we are dealing with every day as African-Americans, as women, as men. But I do believe that, again, I know our other guest said it. You know, one of the things about Donald Trump, it brought everything to the surface. So now we can deal with it. Let's deal with it. Let's teach our kids again. We understand that the vote has power. We need to restore that tradition. We need to vote. We need to teach our children to vote. We need to tell our children that they're beautiful just the way they are. Put beautiful pictures of beautiful black kids and beautiful chocolate women and beautiful chocolate men and all shapes and sizes. Your hair ain't got to be long. And it could be curly. It could be kinky, baby. And if you can wear it bald, you let me kiss your pretty bald head. All I see, we need to start raising another standard of beauty that we lift up our people. So the healers are here. Y'all, let's get healed so we can get those other crazy people healed. All right.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. This has been the Pay to Speak. We're way over time, but this is a discussion that really needs to happen.
We are going to do it again.
Next week, we're going to be continuing PTSD and the effects on the African-American community. We're going to have Bridget Maxey and Eric Thomas. Again, whoo, it's going to be great. So we love you. God bless you all. God keep you all. This has been the Pay to Speak. Hey.
Wrong.
Good night.